Welcome to On The Money, where you can find out anything and everything to do with finance, business, and the economy. On The Money is broadcast live from the studios of Radio 2SER nationwide on the Community Radio Network. I'm Veronica Alashina, and coming up on the program...
Well, I think the problem is that economics today is being taught in almost exactly the same way as it was 40 years ago.
Australian high school students are not enrolling in HSC economics. What are the reasons behind these trends? Also on the show...
If you were unemployed or if you were underemployed, you would have the right to turn up at a job guarantee office, and as a consequence of participating in the job guarantee, you'd get the minimum wage and you get the normal set of working conditions, superannuation, etc.
Underemployment, a new take on an old problem. The continuation of our three-part report on new monetary theory. All this and more coming up on The Money. But first, the Australian Criminal Intelligence Commission last week released the latest report from the National Wastewater Drug Monitoring Program. It stated that Australians are spending over $9.3 billion a year on hard drugs such as cocaine and methamphetamines. They arrived at that number by using wastewater testing from plants all around the country. Ben Robinson asked Shane Nielsen, head of the High Risk and Emerging Drugs Special Operation at ACIC, how wastewater sampling actually works.
A wastewater sample is a part of the wastewater that's collected in the pipes under all of our cities and towns and goes to a treatment plant. Now, that sample is tested before it goes into the treatment plant for a whole range of substances, but in our case, it's tested for illicit drugs and drugs that can be used in illicit markets.
The program tested 58 national sites, 22 in each capital city and 36 in major regional areas right across the country. In total, the ACIC believes that 56% of the Australian population was tested. That's roughly 13 million people. So the program's range reached far and wide. But Mr. Nielsen claims the program was highly accurate.
The beauty of the wastewater scheme is that it's a measure of the quantities in the actual wastewater system. So it has scientific validity. It's been used over a period of time. And all of the uncertainties are listed in the report. But what we like about it is that those uncertainties are either constant or reducing. So the trends that we are seeing are reliable.
Mr. Nielsen stands by the program's results and says they are reliable, but not all experts agree. Professor Alison Ritter is the director of the Drug Policy Modelling Program at University of New South Wales, but she's also one of the leading Australian experts in drug usage and its impact on society. She disagrees with the ACIC in the sense that, according to her, the wastewater testing program isn't all that accurate.
What wastewater analysis does is it detects the presence of drug metabolites in urine or in sewage. That's all it does. It doesn't tell you how many people are using. It doesn't tell you whether that use is harmful. For example, you could have 10 people using a very small amount of cocaine, and what's excreted into the sewage will be the same amount of the metabolite as one person using 10 times as much cocaine, because all you're testing is the metabolite in the sewage.
According to Professor Ritter, there is another major discrepancy in the data. If you read through the stats in the report, you won't come across anything for cannabis. The report states that methamphetamines are the most popularly used drug in the country. However, The 2016 National Drug Household Survey found that only 6.3% of Australians have tried meth in their lifetime, compared to 35% for cannabis.
You will see the absence of cannabis. Cannabis is the most commonly consumed drug in Australia. So when they say things like the most commonly consumed drug was methamphetamine, it's wrong, because all they're doing is detecting the metabolites of certain drugs in the sewerage, not all of the drugs that are consumed by Australians, of which the most common drug is cannabis.
Let's shift now to the discussion of legalisation. When the ACIC report was released last week, the CEO of the commission, Michael Phelan, called the money spent on drugs a waste and said that it could instead be spent on, and I quote, legitimate goods for themselves and their families. New South Wales Greens MP David Shoebridge, however, doesn't believe it's that simple.
I think people need to realise the limits of politics and the limits of, you know, well-meaning words by senior police officials. Just saying no, an abstinence-only approach, trying to convince people to change their consumption patterns from cocaine to celery. I mean, these are things that can't be done by politics. People will always choose, a proportion of people will always choose to purchase some drugs to change their state of mind. And as much as some senior police officer may want to preach abstinence or try and convert people's spending habits, it's not able to be done. History proves that. It's about time we understood that drugs are here, not just for the next 6 months, but they're here whilst ever we have human society. We need to minimise the harm, regulate out the harm, and try and keep criminals away from it.
When it was announced that Australians spent $9.3 billion a year on drugs, a lot of people started discussing what this means for the national conversation about drugs, particularly the calls for drug law reform. There is, of course, the argument that with legalisation, that $9.3 billion could be circulated in a regulated white market economy. But Shane Nielsen from the ACIC doesn't believe that argument entirely holds up.
One of the major problems with that argument, of course, is that what has happened previously when that has been attempted, the organised crime will always look for opportunity. If, for example, a commodity was to be legalised, that commodity would inevitably be taxed, and there would be a component of the price that would be higher than is currently being supplied in organised crime. So in our view, it's naive to think that because you legalise something, organised crime will disappear. What they would continue to do would be to undercut the legitimate price, if you could put that in inverted commas, and still sell at the lower levels they would sell at, because they're not bound by taxation. They don't pay tax.
There may be truth in the fact that drug dealers do not pay tax on the money they earn from drug sales. However, drug dealers still put money into the economy. When I spoke to Professor Ritter, she brought up the age-old debate about whether or not the black market should be included in the GDP.
So there's a big debate about whether the black economy is actually should not be counted in gross domestic product. So there's an argument to say even though it's a black economy, it's still an economy. It's giving people employment. It's giving people income. So drug dealers are receiving income for selling drugs, and they're spending that income on rent, cars, whatever they're spending their income on, and that contributes to economic growth. So there is quite an interesting debate at the moment about whether gross domestic product should actually include black market, because these are areas of economic activity that do the same things as the legal market and should be included in GDP estimates.
When I spoke to David Shoebridge, I told him what Mr. Nielsen had said about how drug dealers will always find a way to stay in the black market. Perhaps unsurprisingly, though, Mr. Shoebridge found a flaw in that argument.
Well, I think the Australian Criminal Intelligence Commission is just trying to come up with justifications for maintaining their monopoly on regulating whole classes of drugs. We know from alcohol, there's a very high excise level charged on alcohol, but we don't have a large criminal bootleg industry. There's a very high excise, even higher excise, charged on nicotine. And yes, there is some small amount of illegal nicotine sales, but it's a tiny proportion of the overall market. Regulating drugs, providing them in a publicly well-regulated environment drives criminals out of the market, and history proves that.
David Shoebridge, New South Wales Greens MP, ending that report by Ben Robinson.
On the Money, making mountains out of moolah.
Listening to On the Money around Australia on the Community Radio Network. I'm Veronica Alashina. According to data gathered by the Reserve Bank of Australia, Year 12 enrolments in economics courses have plunged 70% nationwide over the last 25 years. Enrolments are so low, many schools are abandoning the subject altogether. Max Tillman asked Matt Grudnov, senior economist at the Australia Institute, about how economics can adapt to the modern age.
Well, I think the problem is that economics today is being taught in almost exactly the same way as it was 40 years ago. And I don't think that it is those that are teaching it are showing it how it's relevant and how it can solve today's problems. Kids today are interested in things like climate change. They're interested in inequality. They're interested in why they can't buy a house. They're interested in why they can't have a full-time employment, but they have to endure an endless stream of gig jobs. Now, economics has something to say on all of those things, but the way it's being taught, and in particular the emphasis that's put on the private market and how it solves all the problems, is part of the problem that economics has, because free markets are actually part of the cause of a lot of these problems that people today are trying to solve. So it really needs to update itself.
As you mentioned, the free market has obviously created this contemporary understanding of university as a way of honing in on a more specialised role and particularly specialised degrees. So has this negated the demand for a general economics degree as opposed to a more specialised degree that may give you a better prospect of employment?
Possibly. But I mean, as the RBA shows, there's no shortage of demand for economists. Being good economists at the RBA, they assume that higher wages are what's going to attract people. If supply is not enough, then the price will go up. Unfortunately, that's not what motivates a lot of people towards what they want to do as their job. And so I think what economics is doing is not so much the specialisation, it's just that it's not attracting people because it's not answering the questions that they want or solving the problems, I should say, that people, particularly young people, are actually interested in.
The figures also indicate that economics courses are quite skewed in terms of the gender divide. So the figure suggests that there was a 50-50% ratio in 1992 between men and women studying economics in high school. However, those statistics have changed an enormous amount. So what are some of the ways that economics can shed this perceived boys' club reputation?
Well, I think it needs to shed its over-reliance on mathematics. So the problem economics faces is that rather than look at the world as it is and try and solve real-world problems, it has tended to go down this idea of creating models that look almost like the world but not quite, assuming the world is like the model, and then diving deep into this sort of mathematics of this imaginary model world and sort of fine-tuning that rather than trying to apply it to the real world. I think that, the higher wages and the whole obsession with mathematics, I think, tends to attract males more than females. But if economics takes a step back, reinvents itself and starts thinking about real-world problems and how they're going to solve those, then I think that will go a long way to helping with the gender imbalance.
Has it become, to an extent, a purely academic pursuit as opposed to one that has real-world applications?
I think that's the key problem. I think that, yes, they're interested in it as an academic idea rather than a toolbox. So economics at its best is a toolbox that can solve problems. And I did economics and I love economics and I think more people should study economics. I just think that it's the way we teach economics and the way we use economics in the real world that's actually letting it down. And it doesn't have to be like that. Economics has a lot to say about how you can regulate markets. It has a lot to say about how the government can help make a fairer and more equal society. It's just that we have focused on one small aspect of economics in the teaching of it, and in doing that, we've made ourselves irrelevant.
And the Reserve Bank have found that most of the boys studying economics are from high-income families. So what is your view on the spread of financial literacy across social stratas?
Well, yeah, again, that's another interesting result, but it kind of makes sense. If economics graduates get decent wages, then, you know, it's not surprising that those on higher incomes are more attracted to that, will come from higher income families. The problem is that that's not necessarily what we want in economics. What you need is a spread of different people with different backgrounds learning economics and then applying that to the real world. You don't solve problems by just having a small group that all look the same trying to answer the questions. That's how you end up coming to the wrong answer or coming to a particular sort of focus on one particular aspect and ignoring the breadth of the problem.
Matt Grudnov, senior economist at the Australia Institute, ending that report by Max Tillman.
If your dollars don't make sense, listen to On the Money.
I'm Veronica Alashina, and I've been reading a great economics book that I'd love to recommend to you. What is this new obsession with meditation? Why has Google employed a jolly good fellow? And why is there a self-help guru at Emmanuel's desk shouting at him to shit belief? In his book, The Happiness Industry, William Davies looks at what happens when individual happiness and well-being become a facet of global economic management. Now, we know that without a particular level of commitment from employees, businesses run into tangible problems. And research shows that there is a direct correlation between the happiness of employees and business profits. So in the new business culture of happiness camps, talent analytics software, and neuroscience research into the impacts of positive psychology, Davis asks the question, to what extent should economic policies be permitted to govern our inner lives? This is a great read for anyone interested in business management and getting that 10% increase in profits that true employee happiness is said to achieve. Last week, we started a report on the newly emerging Modern Monetary Theory, or MMT. Developed in the 1990s, MMT proposes that federal government deficits should be treated as normal rather than something undesirable. Vincent Hsu continues his report from last week and asks Stefan Hale, Professor of Economics at the University of Adelaide, to explain how a federal job guarantee would be a key part of the MMT.
That federal job guarantee would mean that if you were unemployed or if you were underemployed, you would have the right to turn up at a job guarantee office in your local community, and you'd have a variety of different productive tasks that you could participate in if you wanted to. And as a consequence of participating in the job guarantee, you'd get the minimum wage and you'd get the normal set of working conditions, superannuation, etc. The idea would be to eliminate involuntary unemployment in Australia. Now, the question that people ask when you talk about a federal job guarantee, or one of the questions people ask anyway, is how would you pay for it? The way in which we'd pay for it is we would have slightly more deficit spending than there is at the moment. Indeed, as I said, the government is talking about an inappropriate fiscal surplus next year. I believe that the fiscal deficit, given the degree of excess capacity in the Australian economy at the moment, should be something like 2 or 3% of GDP. And a federal job guarantee would cost or it would vary over time depending on the state of the economy, but it would cost about 1.5% of GDP, and it would be the way in which I and people that agree with me would set the appropriate size of the fiscal deficit in order to give us full employment, in order to permanently eliminate involuntary unemployment, in order to ensure that the government spent the right amount of money at the right time, on the right people, in the right places, so that we no longer restrained inflation in Australia by relying on a pool of unemployed people, disciplining workers and keeping wage demands under control that way through the threat of unemployment. But instead, if it was necessary to slow down the economy in the future because inflation was picking up because of too much spending, people would still have the opportunity to participate in social provisioning, to work in a job guarantee, to work on environmental projects or social care projects, or in charities or not-for-profits, or in small environmental projects, or art and cultural projects, rather than being thrown on the scrap heap.
Going back all the way to the start of the interview, you mentioned that modern monetary theory had its origins in Keynesian economics. So what is the difference between modern monetary theory and Keynes's theory?
I said that modern monetary theory is linked to something that was called functional finance back in the 1940s, which was developed by a Keynesian economist, yes. The Keynesian economics, at least how that term ended up being used after the death of Keynes during the 60s and 70s and ever since, is often interpreted as the idea that although the government should balance its budget or be close to balancing its budget across an economic cycle, it might be appropriate for the government to use a fiscal stimulus to go into deficit or to go into a bigger deficit when there's a recession in order to limit the scope of the recession and promote economic recovery. But then once the economy has recovered, the government should be balancing its budget or even running a surplus again. We do not accept that. Indeed, we think that that notion, that's the appropriate way for the government to manage its finances, is contradicted by economic history. I mean, if you look at the Australian government's budget, for example, in the years I was talking about before, between 1950 and 1975, and using the Commonwealth government balance as it was defined at the time, the statistics as they were published at the time, there wasn't a surplus even once. And those were 2.5 decades of full employment. We believe that under normal circumstances in most countries like Australia, it will be necessary for the government in the future, as in the past, to continue to run deficits. When the government runs a deficit, all this means is that the government has spent more money into the economy than it takes out of the economy. That's all. And the government's deficit, as I was saying before, can be thought of as everybody else's surplus. So those funds that the government's spending into circulation and not taxing out again are available for the private sector to save. And the government's debt, if you want to regard it as a debt at all, given that it's repayable in Australian dollars and the government is the issuer of the Australian dollar, can be thought of as the net savings of everybody else in Australian dollars. It's just another way of thinking about the government's finances. Now, this is something which has always been reality. It's not always been understood, but it's always been reality. And the government in countries like Australia has even more fiscal space or freedom to use its budget in order to manage the total level of spending in the economy to create a set of circumstances where we have non-inflationary full employment, as I was talking about before, since 1983 in Australia, because in 1983, Australia moved from a fixed exchange rate to a floating exchange rate. And what that means is that our government and our central bank have no commitment to exchange the Australian dollar for anything else that they could possibly run out of. So the constraint on our government's finances, the constraint on the difference between the amount the government spends and what it raises in taxes in Australia, has nothing to do with government solvency or running out of dollars. Those things are impossible in the Australian monetary system, and instead has everything to do with not spending too much so as to not create inflation, or at least not to drive inflation up beyond a level that we're comfortable with. And I'm perfectly comfortable with the current target range for inflation, which is 2 to 3%. Yeah.
You mentioned that the jobs guarantee was a big part of MMT. So are you envisioning these jobs to be part of the public sector or the private sector? How will it work?
They would you might make exceptions for this as far as startup cooperatives are concerned, but they would be part of the public sector. If we were to introduce this federal job guarantee, we would be reintroducing the Commonwealth Employment Service. If you were unemployed, you would turn up at your local job guarantee office or Commonwealth Employment Service office, and you'd see a counsellor there, and there would be a range of employment opportunities which were available for you to participate in.
Stephen Hale, Professor of Economics at the University of Adelaide, ending part two of that report by Vincent Su. Tune in next week for the final instalment of Modern Monetary Theory. You're listening to On the Money around Australia on the Community Radio Network. I'm Veronica Alashina. That's all we have time for on the Money this week. Tune in again next week to find out everything you need to know about finance, business, and the economy. Thanks to producers Ben Robinson, Max Tillman, and Vincent Su, and executive producer Roderick Chambers. On the Money is produced in the studios of Radio 2SER for the Community Radio Network. You can find all our shows and stories at 2ser.com/onthemoney. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. New episodes are coming out every week. And follow us on Twitter. Look for @onthemoney2ser. Find us on Facebook and Instagram for updates. I'm Veronica Alashina. We will be back again next week to give you the inside running on all things financial. Thanks for your company.
Soundtrack your balmy late summer afternoons with an eclectic mix of vinyl at Newtown Record Fair on Saturday, March 2nd at the Bank Hotel Newtown. Crate dig your favourite pop, rock, hip-hop and funk soul with over 20,000 vinyl records, live DJs, yummy kitchen menu and craft beers on tap. Newtown Record Fair, March 2nd, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. in the back beer garden of the Bank Hotel, King Street, Newtown. NewtownRecordFair.com.au, a vinyl sponsor of 2SER.
LA-based Grammy-nominated neo-soul quintet The Internet make their Sydney Opera House debut this March, performing songs from across their career, including 2018's stunning and seductive Hive Mind. In the beautiful surrounds of the concert hall, book now for The Internet. March 6th at sydneyoperahouse.com. Sponsors of 2SER.